From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and President Obama has signed that three-month extension of transportation funding just in the nick of time, but did chide lawmakers for passing short-term measures. So mark your calendars. We'll be talking about highway funding again in about 3 months.
But right now, we want to get to that terrible poaching incident in Africa. Not Cecil the Lion, whose death in that illegal hunt caused outrage, but the slaughter of five elephants in a protected park in Kenya on Monday night. Poachers left the mother and her four calves to die after cutting off their tusks. Other elephants then wrapped their trunks around the carcasses to mourn, as elephants do. But conservationists in Kenya are asking, why isn't there more outrage from humans? Now, there are those saying this week that there is too much concern about animals, but why do we care as much as we do? Temple Grandin is a professor of animal science at Colorado State University. You've heard her here before. She has autism and a special understanding of animals, and now consults with the livestock industry on how to treat livestock more compassionately. Temple, welcome back.
It's good to be here.
What is your thinking? Why has there been such reaction to Cecil the Lion?
Well, Cecil had a name, for one thing. This was a lion that everybody knew. But this dentist was really terrible. I mean, this guy had a history of game violations, trying to kill a lion with an arrow. That's totally cruel.
You've been very open about your own autism, which often is an inability to feel certain emotions.
Well, the thing that's helped me understand animals is I don't think in words. I think in pictures. And the first thing you've got to do to understand animals, get away from words. Now, where there's a similarity with autism is in the cognition, not in the emotion. The emotion that animals have would be similar to people, but the cognition's different because it's sensory-based. You know, all the memories are going to be smell whiffs. They're going to be sound. They're going to be visual pictures because they don't have words.
Well, it's so interesting because you say, as someone with autism, you react to pictures, not words. Thousands of words have been spoken about poaching and illegal hunting, but it seems like one picture of this majestic creature is what got to people even without autism.
That's right. A picture is worth a thousand words. Get away from words. It's sensory. I've discussed that in my book, Animals in Translation.
Now, you mentioned that Cecil had a name. You know, we understand that that does do something. It personalizes the animal, and that there's something in our brains, in the amygdala, that is wired to be compassionate to animals.
Well, definitely. In fact, I read an interesting neuroscience paper on an epilepsy patient, and when they do brain surgery on epileptics, they have to do it fully conscious to make sure they don't take out the important part when they take out the seizure part. And they had electrodes down the man's amygdala, which is the emotion center, and they showed him pictures of animals, both cute and scary, pictures of famous people, and pictures of landmarks. And the animal pictures, either cute or scary, set off the amygdala much more than the pictures of people or the pictures of famous places. Hmm. I thought that was really interesting. It shows that we have a connection to animals.
Well, and Robert Siegel, NPR's Robert Siegel, spoke to some scientists a couple years back, and they pointed out that early on in man's history, you had to be very aware of animals and discern which one was cute and which one was going to eat you. Otherwise, you wouldn't survive.
Well, that's absolutely right.
Well, and so back to this lion, Ernest Small, who's a PhD within the Canadian government. He specializes in biodiversity. He's published several papers on why humans favor some animals over others. And he says one of the universally admired physical characteristics is size. It's called charismatic megafauna, animals that are generally maybe even larger than a man, that there's something, maybe, I don't know, you tell us, because you are something of an animal whisperer, that you can almost look in their eyes and see our own humanity.
Animals know individuals. There's some new research right now that shows that the cows can recognize the voice of another cow individually. Sisters and moms graze together. A lot of ranchers have found that when they work cattle, they'll put the ear tags in that have sequential numbers. And then the next year when they run the cattle through the chute, they're coming in the same order of the ear tags they put in last year.
Hmm. So are you saying that maybe one of the things we're recognizing when we look at a Cecil the Lion is that we're maybe honoring them as a species as valuable as our own?
Well, lions are really majestic. I mean, ever since I was a young child, they've been called the king of the jungle. Well, also people interested in Cecil's family. I mean, Cecil, even though he's an older lion, you know, had a pride of his own. And another thing that upsets a lot of people, because there's a very nasty thing about lion behavior, is when the head of the pride leaves and a new lion takes over, it kills all the babies from the previous pride. Mm-hmm. You have to stop the demand for animal parts. I think it's really important to get those trades cut off.
Well, Huffington Post mentions two places where people can funnel their outrage right now, Panthera and the Savo Trust. Both of them work towards just that goal. Temple Grandin, again, professor of animal science at Colorado State University. Thanks so much.
Well, it was great to be here. Thank you very much.
Well, given the improving diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba, it may surprise you that at two recent international sporting events, 18 Cuban athletes defected to the United States. It doesn't surprise our next guest, who says in all 30 Cuban athletes have recently defected to the U.S. Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria is the Sterling Professor of Hispanic and Comparative Literature at Yale University. Dr. Echevarria, welcome.
I am happy to be here.
Well, why are people still defecting from Cuba like this?
Well, what do you mean still? It's naive to think that because relations between the United States and Cuba are being reestablished, that this is going to change the lives of ordinary Cubans.
Why is that naive to think that?
Because things in politics don't happen so quickly. And what will happen is that the ruling elite will continue to improve its lives. They control everything. They have power. They have money. They have luxury. Fidel Castro's son, Antonio, was just involved in a scandal in Turkey where he had arrived in a 50-yard yacht and had hired four very expensive suites with his bodyguards and all of that. He's the one involved with baseball. But ordinary Cubans are not going to see a change in the near future, if at all. And the lives of the productive lives of athletes are very short. So let us assume that it's going to take 5 years for conditions to improve in Cuba. 5 years is almost half the productive life of most athletes. So they are in a hurry to go somewhere where they can have some sort of a future.
If they want to make it as an athlete, they've got to get going right now because it won't last forever. When you say
right.
5 years, is that what your expectation is? Is that when things will change?
Yeah, if they change very much. But you also have to put this 30 who left in the context of the many others who are leaving Cuba. I just read that 28 of them were in Honduras. 20-some had reached Puerto Rico. People are leaving in droves. The idea that the relationship with the United States are being reestablished does not tell them that their lives are going to improve. These athletes who defect, they just don't want to come to the United States to make money as athletes, but to have freedom. I mean, many ball players have made it, baseball players, and made millions. But many others who came, many other baseball players, didn't make it. They went through the minors, and they are all over the United States making common lives. One is a refrigerator repairman in Tampa, but he's having the freedom and the future that he would not have in Cuba. So the important word here is freedom. And a future also.
If these athletes keep fleeing, why does Cuba keep letting them compete internationally if they're flight risks?
Because these commissars are deluded, still deluded into thinking that they can brainwash people enough so that they will follow, toe the line. I mean, before each delegation leaves, they go through the process of what is called embanderamiento, which is to wrap them in the flag, in the Cuban flag. That means it's a pep rally, like the pep rallies that you have in schools here before football games. It's a pep rally, telling them to be faithful to the revolution, to be faithful to Fidel Castro and to Raul Castro and all of that. And they still hope that that will be enough for them not to leave their teams. The ones who did return after the Pan American Games were given the Medal of Dignity in Cuba for having returned, for not having left their teams. But, you know, you cannot eat metals. There has to be something more substantial as a reward. And so I think it is a form of delusion that may also occur at other levels and will weaken the regime. This very old, I think the guy in charge of sports is in his 90s. I mean, this is a geriatric regime run by very old people who still cling to their ideas, and they still cling to the notion that they can brainwash the athletes.
That's Roberto Gonzalez Echevarria, who is the Sterling Professor of Hispanic and Comparative Literature at Yale University. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's Here and Now, and why is there a barbershop in here? Oh, right, because it's that time of the week.
Here and Now, 2016.
Thanks, boys.
One of these days I'm going to burst out with a light of rose when
well,
I do that.
Well, it is time for our weekly 2016 political roundtable. This week in presidential politics, Donald Trump stays out in front of a crowded Republican field, which got even more crowded, 17 of them now. And Republicans are less than a week away from their first primetime debate.
So joining us, NPR's politics editor, Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hi there. Thanks for having me, as always.
And Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM Radio. Welcome to you as well.
Thanks. Great to be back with you guys.
And Domenico, let's start with you. The first Republican debate, as Jeremy said, Thursday, 17 candidates in the race, only 10 allowed on the main stage. Although Fox said this week it is going to relax its rules and have those who don't make that 10 cut on the main stage do a separate debate earlier in the night, but that's not prime time. But anyway, look at those who made that big debate, those who didn't. Name a few who are going to surprise people for either being there or not being there.
Were you about to call that the kids' table?
I sort of was.
Debate? I kind of we're calling it, I think, appropriately the undercard, you know,
because
it leads off the next debate. But as somebody who's helped put together a lot of these kinds of debates, I kind of feel for the researchers, because can you imagine the turn after trying to figure out what the questions were in that first debate and then have to inform the anchors and all that for that second debate? It's going to be a little bit of a mess. But we right now have the top 10, and really there's a couple more polls expected before Tuesday when the cutoff is, an NBC Wall Street Journal poll and a couple of others, and they'll take the average of the top five national polls. And really, this is very arbitrary when you get down to looking at like 8 to 12, because we're looking at numbers like Ted Cruz and Ben Carson at 5.2, 5.1%, Chris Christie with the whopping 3.3%, John Kasich, governor of Ohio, who with an ad campaign has now surged to a massive 2.7%.
Is that going to let him on the stage? Do you think he would make it?
Well, it depends on what the other polls wind up showing. But at 2.7 right now, he would be number 10. Rick Perry is the one who kind of loses out here at 2.3%. And Rick Santorum and Bobby Jindal somewhat further down. But when you look at the margin of error, looking at 8 to 12, you know, it really is very, very arbitrary. Kasich wants to really get on stage for this debate because he is the governor of Ohio. And it would be a big embarrassment to be left off the stage at a debate in his own state.
Well, Julie Mason, Donald Trump, who's going to be on that stage, he's leading in some of the polls, has said he's not going to prep. How are the what a shock.
Has he ever prepped? That's the point.
But how are the other candidates, what do they have to do to prep for him?
Well, they have to not engage with him. He diminishes everyone who tries to take him on and head on. And he's, you know, he may not prep, Robin, but he does have some political skills. He is very adept at taking a question and turning it into something he wants it to be. He can obfuscate as well as any governor, any member of the Senate. So he's not without some talent when he gets up there, even if he doesn't know, you know, how to reform Medicaid. So the challenge for the other candidates will be to just like let him do his thing and let him hurt himself and not try to engage with him. I kind of feel bad for Rick Perry. I mean, he was getting some real traction going after Donald Trump. He was doing a service for the whole rest of the field, and now he's knocked down of the varsity team.
Well, you know, he was – I want to play something, because this is an interesting question about whether you should engage with him or not engage with him. We heard from John Kasich this week after there was this story about one of Donald Trump's advisors who said in an interview with the Daily Beast that you cannot rape your spouse. He was responding to accusations that Trump's ex-wife, Ivana Trump, made during their divorce in the early 90s. Donald Trump spoke on CNN, distancing himself from the AIDS comment. But then Wolf Blitzer on CNN asked John Kasich what he thought.
Just leave him alone. I mean, obviously, it's a painful story for him, for his family, for his former wife. Leave him alone. That's my reaction.
What do you mean, leave him alone? I don't get that.
Just leave it. Just let it go. Move on. Go to something else. Talk about his policies on something else.
So, Julie Mason, is the best way to deal with Trump just to not engage like that?
Yes, it really is, because it does is give Trump more consequence. It enlivens his supporters. And I would add that it appears that Trump support is leveling off. He may have found a ceiling there. And he doesn't seem to be, gaining more support. So he's just going to hurt himself. That seems to be a good gambit for Kasich.
There's another way to think about this, though. I mean, if you're somebody like Lindsey Graham, who's not on the stage, right, you want to try to engage with Trump so that you can get on to that meteor, that comet, so that you can get some of the attention, because he's sucking up all the oxygen right now. The other part of this, too, is that there's about a quarter of the Republican base, the primary voters, who are sort of this movable feast of voters who really liked Michelle Bachmann, liked Herman Cain, people like that, because they're a fighter. And when someone like John Kasich says, leave him alone, part of that is a political calculation, because he's hoping when Donald Trump does implode, if that ever does happen, that he could take up some of that fighter space, tell it like it is kind of space, because that's something that John Kasich would like to be as well.
Well, you mentioned taking up all the oxygen again. It's really quite astonishing. And so let's give a moment to Jim Gilmore. He is the former perhaps people are saying, what happened with Jim Gilmore?
It'll be his only moment all year.
He didn't get one this week, even though the former Republican governor of Virginia, announced his candidacy. Let's listen.
With so many candidates already in the race, some may ask, why am I running? That's a fair question and deserves a straight answer. I'm a candidate for president because our current Washington leadership is guiding America on a path to decline.
By the way, that was Julie's laugh. That was not in the commercial.
But Julie, anybody who would drag themselves into what's become, our political theater, you have to admire. So tell us who he is.
Well, he's the former governor of Virginia. He obviously has a lot of self-confidence if he is the 17th person into this race. It's crazy. I don't really see what he adds to the conversation. But, hey, God bless him. There's room for everyone in this democracy.
Well, there he is. Okay.
On the other side, we should talk about the Democrats in the few minutes we have left. And Hillary Clinton announcing her climate change plan this week, calling for 33% of the nation's energy to come from renewable sources by 2027. Here she is in Des Moines, Iowa.
The reality of climate change is unforgiving, no matter what the deniers say. Sea levels are rising, ice caps are melting, storms, wildfires, and extreme weather are wreaking havoc. This is one of the most urgent threats of our time, and we have no choice but to rise and meet it.
Domenico, is climate change, do you think, going to be an important issue in this election? And I would also ask, how's Hillary Clinton doing on the Democratic side?
Well, probably not on a base in a general election. It's not really an issue that rises in the polls. You do see it with younger voters as something that they definitely care about. But this is really a base play for Hillary Clinton. She needs to keep intact that Obama coalition and get those younger voters out to the polls. And this, like I said, is an issue that matters for them. Hillary Clinton today doing a very similar kind of thing when it comes to the base, going to the National Urban League Conference, where Jeb Bush, give him credit, was at as well, and talking about Black Lives Matter and that movement, and really trying to coalesce the Democratic base in a key primary. And she's still, the polls are very early and don't tell us a whole heck of a lot, but she does still maintain very large leads, and you're not hearing quite as much about Bernie Sanders, who also had some difficulty with the Black Lives Matters movement, as we've talked about, where he got, it was a difficult moment for him at the Netroots Conference of Liberal Activists.
Right.
And Hillary Clinton has also struggled with that, where she went and said, all lives matter just outside Ferguson, which was not the right thing to do for her base. So you're seeing Democrats struggle on some of these issues. Clinton's still the front runner.
Well, you mentioned Bernie Sanders. He live streamed an event on Wednesday night. The campaign said 100,000 people signed up to watch at viewing parties. Here he is talking about his signature issue, income inequality.
No, it is not acceptable that the rich get richer and everybody else gets poorer. That while we see a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires, we have more kids living in poverty than any other major industrialized society.
You know, you guys, it's interesting. Jeremy and I in the studio, we glance up occasionally and there's on CNN Donald Trump saying, I'm winning in all the polls. But polls this week show that Bernie Sanders would beat Donald Trump in a general election. So just how's he doing?
Go ahead, Domenico.
Maybe Julie's pondering the idea of a Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders general election.
I just fainted.
As I was as well. I just picked Julie up off the floor. that is the unlikeliest of unlikely scenarios. But because these are party elections, this is something I think people have to realize. New Hampshire, Iowa. Most of those delegates don't even have to go and vote for the person who winds up winning that state. So even if Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders were able to pull off wins in those places, the convention delegates and the establishment endorsements are really things that matter, as distasteful as that seems for folks who want to be able to have a direct democracy influence.
Julie Mason, we've just got a few seconds left, but final thought to you. I'm just going to ask you, who do you think's the sleeper candidate in the Republican debate? Who should we be watching? Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Marco Rubio.
Marco Rubio.
He's primed for a comeback. Yeah, he's been a little quiet lately.
All right. Julie Mason, host of The Press Pool on Sirius XM Radio, and Domenico Montanaro, politics editor for NPR. You guys have been great. Thank you so much.
Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You.
Thank you.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson, and it's going to be another big weekend for Puerto Rico. Tomorrow, the U.S. Commonwealth is expected to default on a $58 million bond payment. This comes as Puerto Rico is trying to restructure its $72 billion of debt after Puerto Rico's governor last month said the debt was not payable and that the economy is in a death spiral. Cardiff Garcia is with the Financial Times. He's with us now with more on this. Hi, Cardiff.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what's expected to happen if Puerto Rico does not make this bond payment?
Well, the short version of the answer is that we don't know, partly because there are so many moving parts here. Now, the worst case scenario is that this is the first in a series of defaults that essentially leads to the creditors who want to get paid back on the debt suing the Puerto Rican government and having a lot of this being resolved in the courts. You can imagine how messy that would be.
Yeah.
Probably nobody wants that to be the outcome. Now, the Puerto Rican government is obviously aware of all this. It's appointed a working group that's going to be putting together a series of proposals over the next few weeks for how to reform its economy and how to make the kinds of structural changes that are necessary. But one of the things it's also talking about is the idea of renegotiating some of this debt directly with the creditors. Now, you can understand that the creditors would rather get paid back in full. So they're pushing the government to do things like raising taxes, paying less money into the welfare state. They'd rather get as much money back as they can. The Puerto Rican government also, understandably, would rather not, okay, because that makes the economy worse. And so that's essentially the fundamental source of friction that we're left with.
But when you say creditors, the image I think people get in their minds is like some big institution. Oh, the big creditors. But in this case, a lot of the investors here are just residents of Puerto Rico who are relying on these bonds for income in their retirement or whatever. This would impact the ordinary people of Puerto Rico.
It absolutely would. It's kind of hard to see how it wouldn't. Now, the actual people who own these bonds, and I'm talking about all of the debt, not just what's being paid back tomorrow, is actually a combination of mutual funds, bond funds, hedge funds, and yes, certainly residents, including a lot of people who live in Puerto Rico. And so essentially, they're in trouble no matter what happens, because either they get paid back on these bonds or the Puerto Rican government itself is going to have less money to pay things like public sector salaries for public services and to put money into other parts of the economy. So this is a really quite a difficult and even tragic situation.
Does it surprise you that so far Washington hasn't come in and said, OK, we'll take care of this?
Well, that's kind of a hard question to answer. I mean, I wouldn't say that I'm surprised because I'm never surprised when Washington gets nothing done, right? But in this case, what Washington was contemplating was allowing Puerto Rico to have access to the bankruptcy courts, to the bankruptcy laws, because states in the U.S. aren't allowed to go into bankruptcy, but sub-state entities are, and some of the Puerto Rican debt is in those sub-state entities and the utilities that issue these bonds. And if they could enter the bankruptcy courts, then it would lead to a more orderly process. Mm. Instead, we're threatened with this much messier, much more intractable situation where you might have to have direct renegotiations or eventually lawsuits.
Cardiff Garcia with the Financial Times. And again, we're waiting to see what happens tomorrow when Puerto Rico is expected to default on a $58 million bond payment. But of course, we came up to a situation like this about a month ago, and there was a last-minute deal. So we'll see what happens. Cardiff, thank you so much, as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Experts in the global medical community are reacting to hopeful news today that a vaccine for the Ebola virus is showing real promise. New research published in the medical journal The Lancet has boosted hopes that an effective vaccine may be closer than thought. In a small clinical trial, the vaccine provided 100% protection. NPR's Afebia Quist-Arkton joins us from Dakar, Senegal. She's been part of NPR's Ebola coverage team over the past year and a half. And Afebia, what more do we know about this vaccine?
Well, we were told that the trial happened in Guinea. Now, Guinea is the first country where Ebola was announced a year and a half ago. And it seems that a fragment of the Ebola virus with another safer virus is used in order to, as they put it, train the immune system to beat Ebola. So 100 patients were identified in the trial between April and July, and they were all close contacts of one patient of Ebola, and they were either vaccinated immediately or 3 weeks later. And in the 2,000 plus close contacts of this Ebola sufferer in Guinea who were vaccinated, apparently there were no subsequent cases of the virus. And in those who were vaccinated later, there were 16 cases. And this is why the World Health Organization is saying these results are remarkable, and they feel that this vaccine may be a game changer. But of course, there are the specialists who are saying, hold on, we need to take a deep breath.
Well, what would this mean for Ebola sufferers? How are they treated at this moment?
They need to be caught very early after infection with the disease, because the body can pack up very quickly. There has been no vaccine, there has been no treatment. So what health workers do is make sure that those who are suffering from Ebola have enough water to drink, have oral rehydration salts, so that their body does not pack up. And of the 28,000 cases that have been reported, mainly in the three countries affected, Guinea, Sierra Leone and Liberia, over the past year and a half, 11,000 people have died. So initially it was a frighteningly high death rate. But now we're talking about Liberia, which is more or less Ebola-free since the 9th of May. Guinea is still the weak link, and Sierra Leone still has cases, although up to Sunday last week, it was less than half a dozen in each country. So very slowly, we are getting, hopefully, to no Ebola cases in these three countries, because whilst there is even one case in one of the countries, it means all three countries are at risk.
But why is that the case? Why are there still new cases? We haven't heard in this country, in the United States, we haven't heard a lot about Ebola recently because there haven't been any cases in the U.S. And it seems like the number of cases have been dropping pretty steadily in Africa. But why are there new cases?
Because the Ebola crisis is not over. Okay, perhaps it's not heard much of these days in the United States, but it has not ended in the Ebola region. And why, you ask? Some will say because people are still not reporting Ebola cases. But when I compare with when we were covering Ebola at the height of the epidemic in a year ago in the summer, I mean, now people know as soon as someone shows symptoms, take them to a medical facility where they can be cared for. At the height of Ebola, people were still burying their dead secretly because Ebola was new to the region and people didn't know, and they felt that they had to continue burying their dead, which was laying on hands of the corpse and dead body, all the practices that in these West African countries had been the norm. That was spreading Ebola. Now it appears the message has mainly got through and there are now mainly safe burials. People are not touching dead bodies because corpses, even though the Ebola sufferer is now dead, are still highly toxic and highly contagious. Those messages are finally going through. But medical experts and specialists on Ebola tell us that, you know, although we may eventually get to no cases in the region, Ebola could spring up again, and everybody should be ready for that. That's why this new vaccine that has been trialled in Guinea is being hailed as pioneering and essentially good news, because if there is an Ebola outbreak again, they should be able to use a vaccine such as this to make sure that cases do not run away with the experts and cause an unprecedented epidemic as we've seen in the past year and a half.
That's NPR's international correspondent Afabia Quist-Arctan joining us from Dakar, Senegal, with some good news today in the fight against Ebola. Afabia, thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Robin, I'm sure you've heard that if you look up in the skies tonight here in this country, there will be a blue moon, a rare event that last occurred in 2012.
And won't happen again until 2018. But the reason it's called a blue moon is, well, let's ask our next guest, because Kelly Beattie is senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. And you guys named this, well, you didn't, but back in, what, 1940, the magazine did. Why?
Well, all right, let's start from what we think of it now. It's okay. A blue moon now because it's the second full moon in this month. It takes 29 and a half days to go from full moon to full moon. Every once in a while, once every 3 years or so, you'll get two in 1 month. That's what everybody thinks of as a blue moon.
But it's not blue.
But what it's not blue. You know, it's a relatively rare event. You know, once in a blue moon, I'll win the lottery. But the original definition was not that. It had to do with the sort of timing of seasons. And you know, every month or so we get a full moon. There's three full moons in a season from, say, an equinox to a solstice astronomically. Every once in a while you would get a fourth full moon in that period of time. And that was defined as the blue moon. And this came from the Maine Farmer's Almanac during the 1930s and 40s. Where we got into trouble is, in the 1940s, Sky and Telescope, my magazine, I'll take the hit here, wrote an article about this and misidentified what the root cause of blue moon was. We're the ones who first said it's two full moons in a month, and it stuck.
Well, the Earth is off its axis.
Well, no, but what you're saying is it has everything to do with our calendar and nothing to do with anything else.
It has nothing to do with the moon actually turning blue.
Which it makes people go crazy because they go out to try to find the blue moon. But you can't tell us more about it. I mean, why is it so special? And it sometimes has like a blue tinge.
All right. So two different questions.
Yeah.
It's special calendrically because it doesn't happen very often. And, you know, there are all kinds of cycles in astronomy that come and go. And really, the Greenland ice sheet is not suddenly accelerating its melting because we have these two blue moons. It's just a little quirk in the calendar that allows us to have two. You said we're going to have one in January of 2018, which is true. And then 2 months later in March, there'll be another one. And here's a snap quiz. Can we have a blue moon in February?
I have no
idea. Probably not, because it's such a short month.
Yeah, there you go.
Good for you.
Wait, but what about what Robin was asking about the fact that the moon sometimes is blue?
Very true. When there are special atmospheric conditions, like really fine particles of volcanic haze in the atmosphere, there have been documented instances where the moon has a kind of bluish cast, the sun too, for that matter. Not very common, and not likely to happen tonight.
Well, but tonight, I mean, it always is wonderful to go out and just look at a full moon.
Oh, absolutely. And what I want people to think about is, you know, the moon is kind of unloved and underappreciated. Go out with just your eyeballs or a pair of binoculars. Who's ever thought to look at the moon with binoculars? You can do that and you'll see great things.
Okay. And we've got the Leonids coming up too, right?
Perseids.
Perseids.
Yeah, the Perseid meteor shower is the night of August 12th and the morning of the 13th. It'll be especially good this year. The peak is timed well for the United States, and there will be no full moon. It'll be a new moon that time. That's about 2 weeks from now. So
better see him.
Put that on your calendar.
Yeah.
Kelly Beattie, senior contributing editor of Sky and Telescope magazine, the people who came up with the blue moon. Thank you for joining us as always.
Okay.
Blue moon. You saw me standing alone without a dream in my heart, without a love of my
own. We had to. It's here and now. It's here and now, and we spoke earlier about the outrage over Cecil the Lion. Zimbabwe is trying to extradite Walter Palmer, the American dentist who killed him. But he shut down his business, and there's a sign posted on the door that says, "Rot in Hell." Has the backlash against Palmer gone too far? And what role did social media play? Let's look at this story through that prism with Julia Turner of Slate. Julia, hi.
Hello.
And tell us what you're seeing about Cecil the Lion and Walter Palmer online.
We've seen a succession of responses around Cecil that I think exhibit the social media cycle in a really nice microcosm. So initially there was outrage. People were critiquing this dentist for killing this beloved lion, and people used the social media platforms they had available to do so. So one such social media platform was Yelp. People started protesting this dentist's activity by leaving negative reviews on his dentist practice Yelp board. You know, some of these took a slightly satirical tone. I live in the neighborhood and heard of this mighty White Hunter's dental service for cleaning lion teeth. Alas, there was already a big line of stuffed animals this morning waiting at his locked door, so I think his calendar will be filled. I will be taking my lion elsewhere. That's a one-star review.
Well, and I should jump in to say that, in fact, people did start leaving stuffed animals at the door of his dentist business. And so that is true that happened. Yep.
And then, you know, people started talking about the economics of conservation in Zimbabwe. It became a fodder for a political conversation and a conservation conversation around the notion that why is the internet outraged simply because this dentist killed the wrong lion, when in fact, if he had killed the right lion — people kill lions all the time in Africa, in a practice that some folks decry and others think may be valuable in terms of economically providing the wherewithal to preserve habitat for lions and other animal species in Africa — then came the people who wanted to provide a backlash to the backlash in several respects. Hmm. Why are we spending so much time concerned about this lion when, in fact, we could be concerned about any of a number of other important issues that plague our country? There was a suggestion that if you eat chicken, you are somehow a worse citizen of the globe than this lion-killing dentist. There was also, I think, a sense that because this dentist killed the wrong lion, to hound the man to the point where he must shut down his practice and go into hiding is perhaps an excessive response. And eventually it just becomes a set of people arguing with each other about everything.
Well, and we know the Black Lives Matter movement has a very strong showing on social media, and there was some upset there.
Yeah, there were a ton of people pointing out online that there was a ton of outrage about the death of this particular lion, when in fact men and women of color across the country are killed, and there can sometimes be much less attention or outrage to those incidents. Of course, those comments are being made in a year and an environment where that's changing rapidly. And in fact, social media has become a powerful tool for getting people to pay attention to such incidents.
Right. This is all playing out furiously on social media, as is another incident. And we just want you to touch on this. This is the death of a woman in China. She was on an escalator in a mall with her young child. She hadn't gone there to shop. She didn't have any money. She actually went there just to have her son have a cool place to play. And a panel fell out of this escalator, and it's just horrible. This video has spread around the world of her falling through this faulty panel, pushing her young child to safety. Talk about how this is reverberating in China.
Several videos of this gruesome incident have been circulating. There also have been subsequent videos that show that two mall workers noticed the faulty panel right before and, in fact, warned the woman coming up the escalator but didn't somehow shut down the escalator or prevent her from taking the escalator. So some people in China and elsewhere have been pointing their fingers at them. And then there have been plenty of images circulating online of how Chinese escalator passengers have responded. Some of them are riding the escalators by kind of straddling the handrails in kind of a leapfrog posture as they climb the escalators. Or I saw one woman sort of slouching as though she were sprawled across the top of a piano, except for she had her elbow on one handrail and her feet on the other. You know, some are suggesting that these elaborate modes of riding escalators are simply arising out of fear of safety, that there may be other faulty escalators. Others suggesting it's more a form of social protest, saying, look, this is the corporations and government and regulators in this country are not protecting us, the public, in the way that they should. The additional conversation, I think, is around why this video has been allowed to circulate in China, not typically a place that is known for allowing coverage of incidents like this. And some China experts have theorized that the government is more comfortable allowing the circulation of potentially controversial media like this when the people who seem responsible are more local governments or companies and are a little bit further removed from the central government in China.
Yeah, the central government is saying, yes, go criticize that company over there and get off our backs.
And I think one thing that's striking about it is seeing an incident like this from abroad gives you a feeling that you understand some aspect of Chinese culture and society and how it works because you have unprecedented visibility into it. However, you know, what you're not seeing is the videos that don't circulate or the conversations that don't happen. And so I think you can get a false sense of transparency from abroad when an incident like this rises to circulate on social media here.
That's Julia Turner of Slate talking about how some stories have reverberated on social media. Julia, fascinating. Thanks so much.
Thank you.